Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. New parents have a lot of anxiety when it comes to their children. Among the common issues are growth, coordination, and talking. And of course, when will baby sleep through the night? Since the time of Dr. Benjamin Spock, whole subgenres of how-to books for nervous parents have sprouted up in the publishing world. My guest today is not new in that world, but his latest book is a welcome entrant in the field of, yes, soiled diapers. Brian Vartabedian is a pediatric gastroenterologist at Texas Children's Hospital in Houston and a faculty member of the Baylor College of Medicine. His new book is titled Looking Out for Number 2, a slightly irreverent guide to poo, gas, and other things that come out of your baby. Thankfully, I'm through that stage of parenting, but Vartabedian is a prolific blogger and social media commentator on many medical topics, and this book offers a window into his creative approach to communicating medical concepts to regular people. He's previously authored a book called Colic Solved, so you know that his occupational obsession matches well with that of nervous parents. Warning about today's show, there is discussion of baby waste products, which some may find off-putting, especially close to mealtime, but all done with good humor and educational insight in mind. Dr. Brian Vartabedian of Baylor College of Medicine and Texas Children's Hospital is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Brian Vartabedian, welcome to Medical Monday. Let's start by asking you just to define some terms. For example, one of the terms you focus on in the first part of the book is something called the baby biome. Tell us what you mean by the baby biome.
Yeah, the baby biome is the collective of all the microorganisms that live inside of a baby. And you and I, we talk about it as the microbiome. And just in this book, since I'm focusing on the earliest part of life, I just called it the baby biome. So it's important because babies, interestingly, are born with effectively a sterile gut, and during the first seconds to hours of life, babies start to acquire this new population of bacteria, which, as we're learning, is beginning to play a critical role in health and disease later in life.
You know, one of the things that I think is worth pointing out right here at the outset is that nowadays, I think many of us are conditioned, but certainly parents of young children or first-time parents are frightened of bacteria and germs affecting their children.
Yeah.
And you make the point repeatedly that germs can be pretty good things. They can be our friends. So what's a helpful framework to think about that? I mean, the baby biome is one, so that there's these good bacteria. But essentially, we don't want our kids being sterilized, essentially.
No, absolutely not. And it's interesting, the transition that we've seen over the past generation. If you go back just to a generation ago, we looked at nurses in nurseries with face masks on or sterilizing infant formula and things like that. And these are things that are exactly opposite of where we're headed now, because you're finding that probiotics or good bacteria being added to infant formula. We're learning more about breast milk and the role that living bacteria play in helping seed the gut through breast milk. So our perspective is really changing, and we're recognizing that rather than learning how to fight bacteria or stay away from bacteria, a relationship with bacteria actually is critical. And so, especially during the first months and years of life, being exposed to bacteria and learning how to separate good from bad becomes something really critical to preventing autoimmune disease later in life. In fact, there's a phenomenon called the hygiene hypothesis, which dictates that the cleaner our environment is for children, the more apt they are to develop problems like autoimmune disease later in life.
Right, or allergies to things that typically we haven't been allergic to in the past.
Yeah, absolutely. So when we don't have exposure to these things and we are exposed at a later date, it can create some problems. When we can kind of overreact to these things, it can create some issues.
So let's continue on this theme of bacteria. And one of the points that you make early on in the book is that a vaginal birth is often probably better from the baby's point of view than a C-section. And that has to do with bacteria as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's some data supporting the idea that a child is more likely to have allergies to certain foods when they're born by C-section than by vaginal delivery, and there are a few studies that support this. And it's an interesting finding because it raises this idea that the bacterial exposure the babies have in the birth canal and even shortly after crowning, that exposure, that early exposure alone, may play a role in dictating allergy later in life. So even that earliest exposure can have a real impact. And so it's very, very interesting.
One of the terms that you defined that was new to me is something you call the fourth quarter of pregnancy, I guess. What does that mean?
Well, the fourth trimester.
Fourth trimester.
Right, yeah. Right. So there's in pregnancy, there are three trimesters, and we kind of talk about. And when a baby's born, there's a lot of developing that still has to happen. Just like a baby's arms and his legs are uncoordinated and maybe their eyes deviate a little bit or look funny, babies' intestinal tracts learn to squeeze in sort of a rhythmic way. There are digestive enzymes that mature in advance. So the microbiome or baby biome that we just talked about is developing. And so there's a whole sequence of development that happens during the first 3 months of life that just in the book I refer to as the fourth trimester. And it's just to illustrate the point that the babies are still developing and their gut is still adapting to the world around us. Before birth, they're fed completely by the placenta. After birth, they're completely fed by breast milk or, in some cases, infant formula. And so parents have to understand that and work with that because it's important to understand what's going on.
You refer to the gut, and you make this point that essentially the gut is everything really from our mouth all the way to our bottom.
Uh-huh.
And it's just a giant tube. And one thing that was helpful to remind me, even though I probably learned this in medical school, is that it's helpful probably to think of our gut as being part of the outside, not really inside our body, even though, of course, it is inside our body. But
yeah.
Can you explain that a little better?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. So we think of the mouth, it's when something goes in our mouth and down into our stomach, that it's kind of in our body. But the intestinal tract is really a tube that goes through our body, and it's still kind of on the outside, if that makes any sense. And so the bacteria that are living in our gut are kind of living outside of our body or just on the surface of the body. It was interesting when I went through, when I was writing, looking out for number two, my book, the editor, interestingly, had a hard time understanding that. And so I don't know how important it is to really understand it, except to think that it's the lining of our intestinal tract is almost like skin. But there's a lot happening at that surface, but it is kind of outside of our body.
One other term from the first part of the book I want to ask you about is this notion of helicopter feeders. What do you mean by a helicopter feeder?
You mean helicopter parenting? And so sometimes parents who, when they're feeding their kid, they're constantly hovering over them and sort of obsessed with what their baby's doing or not doing with their food. And oftentimes that kind of attention can lead to problems and stress in a feeding relationship, and so we very often advocate this division of responsibility where it's your responsibility to give a baby food and it's their responsibility to eat it. And so sometimes we give a baby, or certainly late in the first year into toddlerhood, we give a child space. They tend to do better than if we're constantly chasing them with the spoon.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Brian Vartabedian. He is a pediatric gastroenterologist at the Baylor College of Medicine and Texas Children's Hospital and author of the new book, brand new book, Looking Out for Number Two, A Slightly Irreverent Guide to Poo, Gas, and Other Things That Come Out of Your Baby. And Brian, in part one, it's what goes in. Part two is really what comes out. And this, I think, gets to some of the motivation as a pediatric gastroenterologist. You had some parents over the years, so you've been a pediatric gastroenterologist for quite some time, who have, let's just say, have a slight obsession with what comes out of their baby and have collected diapers and brought you frozen samples.
Uh-huh.
Or collections. Would you mind sharing a couple of those anecdotes with us?
You know, it's interesting. We call these parents that kind of get obsessed with what their babies do, we call them stool gazers, and you can read about it in Looking Out for Number Two. But I do tell the story of a mother who froze every diaper that her child had for the month or so leading up to her appointment with me. The baby had some blood in her poo, and mom was real worried, and so froze all of them and put the date and time with Sharpie on the outside. And of course, I'm in Houston at Texas Children's Hospital, and my concern when she showed up was all those diapers were going to defrost right there in my office. And so the whole idea was to get the visit done before they started to stink the place up.
You were on the clock.
Right, I was on the clock. So, yeah, so parents have this obsession with what their babies are doing. I think it probably stems from the fact that babies don't appear on the surface to do very much. They eat, they sleep, and they poop. And so sometimes we, as new parents, we want to make sure things are going fine. And so we look at baby's behavioral state or what they're producing is kind of evidence that the baby's doing well. And so it's a very normal thing for parents to do that. And truth be told, there is a lot we can learn from what babies do in their diaper or what's going on inside. And we talked about the baby biome. There's lots going on in there. And so maybe these parents are smarter than we thought they were.
Well, and I think various pundits have called you the poo whisperer. So you have some ways of understanding some of these patterns from your years of experience. Are there any that you can share with us on the air that would help parents or remind some of our grandparents listening of things they may have seen?
Well, you know, there's a whole lot, and I got about 300 pages of stuff in there. So, but there's a few things that kind of happen that parents get stuck on. One is the big slowdown, as I call it, that happens between a month or two of age. And when a baby's born, of course, they're feeding frequently at the breast, and they're having a lot of poops, oftentimes with every feed. And what happens, interestingly, about a month or two of age, a baby will slow down considerably in the number of poops that they make. This stems from the maturation of the baby biome, which is really taking hold, as well as the motility or squeezing pattern in the intestinal tract starts to get a little bit more mature. So the reason it's important is parents will sometimes perceive that slowdown as constipation when in fact it's a normal maturation of the gut. And so parents will get upset if a child skips a day or has less frequent poops. That's one of the most common ones that I see where parents get tripped up.
What are some, in this chapter you have called 50 Shades of Brown, are there any clues you can give us from stool's color?
Yeah. So another big hang-up that parents have is with neon green poo. And so this gets to the whole idea of how poo gets brown, which is kind of fun. Poo gets its color from a pigment that comes out of the liver called bile, or fluid called bile. And it is green when it comes out of the liver. So if you look just beyond the stomach, it's greenish fluid. But as it makes its way, as that fluid mixes and mixes with digestive enzymes and makes its way down to the bottom, it goes from green to yellow to brown, and our poop gets its brown color from that bile. Now, what happens sometimes, babies will have real rapid transit, or things will move through very quickly through the intestinal tract, and poop will come out neon green, and so parents often freak out. So it's not something to worry about. It's a normal thing to have for a baby to have bright neon green poo, so long as there isn't a lot of diarrhea. In terms of color, the other things that we get concerned about in babies, even adults for that matter, poo that's red obviously means blood. Poo that's black often means old blood. And poo that's white in babies is a real problem because it can mean that there's a blockage up in the liver where that bile comes out. So those are the three colors that we look for that we really get worried about. Everything else is sort of trivial.
What do you recommend? I recognize there's many causes of diarrhea, but for a new parent who's experiencing a change in the baby's or child's pattern of bowel movements where they are, you know, having many more frequent stools, do you test right away or do you recommend empiric treatments?
Yeah. What's interesting about diarrhea is if you look into the medical literature and all the research journals, you'll see that it's really hard to come up with a real firm definition of diarrhea. Even experts can't fully agree on what constitutes diarrhea. So for our purposes, we'll just say that it's increased frequency and decreased consistency. So poop that's loose and more frequent, we can call diarrhea. I think what's most important for parents to understand is what their baby's normal is. Some babies who are breastfed have looser, runnier poo, and just knowing your baby's normal is the most important thing. The most common cause of diarrhea that happens suddenly in babies, of course, is viruses, which they get into pretty frequently. And the most important thing for parents to keep in mind in that circumstance is to maintain a baby's hydration, because as you'll learn in the book, the vast majority of poop is water. So when babies have lots of poo, they're at very high risk of dehydration. So make sure you get that baby checked out, because hours can make a big difference.
Okay, and there's another topic here that I want to ask you about, and you've written about this before, but first of all, remind us what colic is and then why you titled this section The Vast Colic Conspiracy.
Yeah. So colic is a term that was first described in 1954 by some doctors, I think up in Boston, and it was a term used to describe a behavioral state in babies when they cried more than 3 hours a day for 3 days a week for at least 3 weeks. So at that time, when that term was first coined, we knew very little about what was going on inside of babies. And as you'll see in looking out for number two, there's a whole lot we now know about what happens inside of babies, and in fact there's some fair amount of research to support that up to half of babies who have what was once described as colic actually have milk protein allergy. And so allergy is something we think about. Acid reflux is something we think about to explain crying in babies, as well as what's called dysbiosis, or disruptions in the baby biome. And so what was once colic and kind of this garbage term, a lot of these babies now have causes that can be explained. And so I think it's passing. It's a term that's kind of passing into the wayside. And in the book, I kind of outline that I think it's really not a good term that we should be using in babies.
Becoming more of one of those archaic terms you'll hear thrown around every now and again, like lumbago or something.
Yeah, exactly, something like that.
Let's just stick with one more topic from the book, and it comes up a fair bit, and you mentioned it, like a milk protein allergy, and we talked about the baby biome and how having the good, healthy bacteria make you less likely to have allergy or autoimmune diseases. You asked the question, maybe rhetorically, can you prevent allergy to begin with? What do we know about that?
Yeah, well, one of the best things that we can do, or one of the easiest things that any parent can do to prevent allergy, is to breastfeed. It's one of the best protective mechanisms we have for preventing allergy, as well as preventing a lot of other diseases later on in life as well. So breastfeeding is the best place to start. New evidence emerging and new recommendations from the allergists that do research on this, that early introduction of foods such as peanuts, in fact, during the early months of life, may be helpful in preventing the subsequent development of peanut allergy. So the story is really evolving, and the whole idea of withholding foods to prevent allergy is turning, as we're learning that early introduction of certain antigens or proteins can be helpful in preventing allergy.
Yeah, I mean, that was just downright shocking to me, that recent news you pointed out to introduce peanuts, because for
right.
so long that had been the dogma, you know, do not give anything related to a peanut to a child for at least the first year of life. So it just turned that advice totally on its head.
Yeah, exactly. And at the American Academy of Pediatrics national meeting last year, it was just amazing being on the exhibit floor, because there's a whole market emerging for products that sell peanut paste to give to babies. So it's funny, and you add that with the idea that we're putting bacteria into infant formula, it's like the, you know, cat sleeping with dogs, and it's crazy.
Well, you're listening to Medical Monday on Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. Brian Vortabedian. He is a longtime pediatric gastroenterologist at the Baylor College of Medicine and at Texas Children's Hospital. This book is subtitled, well, we'll give you the whole title, Looking Out for Number 2, A Slightly Irreverent Guide to Poo, Gas, and Other Things That Come Out of Your Baby. So irreverent, you have a great sense of humor, and it's reflected in the book, which is one of the reasons I wanted to talk about it today. Where did what led you to write this book? Where did the inspiration come from?
Well, you know, for 20 years, again, working at Texas Children's Hospital, actually the largest children's hospital in the United States, I've dealt with lots and lots of families and lots of stoolgazers, and so I thought it would make sense to take some of the wisdom that I've accumulated over the years and kind of put it together in a book in a way that's kind of fun and approachable. On top of it, as I suggested, there's a whole lot we're learning about the importance of early protein introduction and the microbiome and everything else that I thought made for some really interesting reading. And so I put together something that I think is kind of entertaining and informative, and it's fun to create a resource like this for parents.
Yeah, well, congratulations. It is a great resource. And I mean, I'm out of that stage of worrying about the baby's diapers, but I still had a great time reading it. So I want to turn a little bit to, we talked about your inspiration. Now, you are a longtime medical blogger, but creativity really as a physician is one of the themes that you often explore. And you write a blog that's very well known in the medical community called 33 Charts,
uh-huh.
And with the subtitle Exploring the Edges of Medicine and Technology. So is technology just sort of a hobby for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've really enjoyed watching medicine change over the past generation or so. Interestingly, I was sort of raised before the Internet as a physician. I was trained before the Internet, and early in my career, the Internet appeared. And watching the evolution of patients who had access to information on the Internet and watching myself change and their relationship with me change has really been fascinating. And on top of that, all the new personal technology that's emerging, it's really changing what it means to be a physician. And so it's something that's kind of a pet interest of mine, maybe the subject of my next book, who knows. But it's something I love thinking about and watching.
You know, I read your blog pretty regularly, and one of the things I notice is you often will make very short posts, you know, which make them all the more readable. But there's just a kernel. There's a thought or a kernel, and you really color it well and explain it well, and it doesn't go on at great length. So that's very friendly to a busy professional.
Mm-hmm.
But moreover, you know, this concept of creativity, like you, if I understand it correctly, you think of professionals, but specifically in this case, doctors, but it could be anyone, as creatives, as types who are, you know, who are constantly teaching, right? We know the root of docere, doctor, is to teach. And so you really encourage your colleagues, your readers to pursue their passions, whether it's, you know, how they present information to their colleagues or to students or to, of course, to patients and their families.
Right.
And everyone sort of does it a different way. Now, you've gone old-fashioned here by writing a book. But
right.
There are a lot of other ways to do it and ways that you've explored. You know, you've become, I would say, somewhat of an evangelist for this.
Yeah. You know, writing a book is really a creative process. And as physicians, I would say probably traditionally, we're sort of trained to walk in lockstep with, like, the generation before us. You know what I mean? From very early on, from our pre-medical school training right through medical school, we're not really, you know, encouraged to be risk takers. We're encouraged to do exactly what was done before. Medicine is very sort of prescriptive, where it's algorithmic. We follow these strict rules of diagnosis and so on and so forth. And so thinking creatively or thinking outside the box is not something that physicians are really trained to do. And so early on, as a freelance writer, at creative end, and then later in writing online, it's been an amazing outlet for me. And I really think it's important for doctors to kind of find some creative element in their world, be it a startup or making an app or writing or painting or drawing that can be used and leveraged. And so it's important for, I think, for preventing burnout, you know, more and more. I think it's becoming a key thing. It keeps me going, keeps me excited.
Yeah, so finding meaning in the work and new ways of expressing
exactly.
yourself. Yeah, so it really marries your art and your profession and the art of medicine.
Yeah, yeah. I look at my colleagues who are really kind of discouraged and burnt out. They kind of, I don't think they look beyond like their day-to-day work, and it's just a recipe for disaster, in my opinion. So it's been exciting, and it's been a fun journey to sort of see what's happening in the world of technology and write about it. And I'm thinking of moving a little bit into longer form writing, and even some of the stuff that you do with NPR is amazing. I'd like to do a little bit more of that.
Well, the name of the book is Looking Out for Number 2, A Slightly Irreverent Guide to Poo, Gas, and Other Things That Come Out of Your Baby. And it is just out from Harper Wave. And it's by my guest today, Brian Vardabedian, who is a pediatric gastroenterologist at the Baylor College of Medicine and Texas Children's Hospital. And Brian, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very, very much. I appreciate you having me.
And now some thoughts from Connie Cronley, a writer and essayist who offers us this reflection on how the Bronte sisters can help inform us in present times.
I have come to the conclusion that Oklahoma is Emily Bronte country, not Charlotte Bronte, who wrote Jane Eyre, a novel of redemptive love and kindness. No, I mean Emily Bronte, the sister who wrote Wuthering Heights, which is not, as we like to think of it, a romantic novel of a powerful love. No, it's a story of anger, jealousy, and revenge in the Yorkshire moors, where both the people and the countryside are fierce and harsh. The title gives it away. Wuthering means a climate that is windy, wild, and stormy. Hello, Oklahoma! Emily is my favorite of the Bronte sisters. Charlotte longed to be sociable and pretty. Emily didn't give a damn, and she wrote in a style that, for her time, was close to that language. She was reclusive, disagreeable, and immovably obstinate. She once wrote an essay in defense of cats, saying that their bad qualities of hypocrisy, cruelty, and ingratitude made them closely resemble humans. All of the Bronte sisters wrote in rebellion. Charlotte's strong protagonist, Jane Eyre, railed against unjustness for Victorian women. She had her characters say that if we are kind and obedient to those who are cruel and unjust, the wicked people will have it their own way. No, she said, when we are struck without reason, we should strike back again very hard. Jane Eyre was published in 1848 and became an immediate media sensation and a part of a revolutionary year in England. Queen Victoria stayed up late reading it to Prince Albert. Florence Nightingale read it and decided to find a meaningful occupation. The workers who hadn't benefited from the wealth of the Industrial Revolution marched in the streets protesting the political establishment and aristocrats. If Charlotte's book is about a young woman demanding dignity and independence, Emily's book, published the year before in 1847, was a howl of fury, but it was also a portrayal of evil wrapped in the character of Heathcliff. He is a man consumed by anger, vengeance, and self-righteousness. He doesn't try to build up the society around him. He destroys. At one point, he cries out, "I have no pity. The more the worms writhe, the more I yearn to crush out their entrails." Which brings me back to Oklahoma, my home state, where sometimes we seem as primitive as Emily's Wuthering Moors, preoccupied with sex and religion and dedicated to a state budget that lets the worms writhe. What makes us a great nation is that we are a nation always in revolution. We revolt against injustices, child labor, civil rights, women's suffrage, gay rights, and so much more. We advocate for the poor, the weak, and the persecuted, unless, of course, they're in our own backyard. I am assured that we have state politicians working hard for the greater good, but it's the others who turn me into Emily Bronte. Now, what can I personally do to protest them? Can I dump tea in the Arkansas River? Can I set up a mock guillotine on Guthrie Green? How can I revolt against a legislator who wants to sic immigration authorities on children who don't speak English, or who says publicly that rape and incest are God's will? Well, I could write them a letter of protest, but what do they care? I'm not in their district. I can't vote for them. I can boycott Broken Arrow, Wagner, and Muskogee, but so what? I don't go there anyway. July is the birth month of Emily Bronte, a month that is hotter than bedamned in Oklahoma. Maybe I can channel that heat and Emily's ferocious spirit. Maybe I could write a Bronte book of local revolution, a book that says to our lesser legislators, tame your mean souls and still the winds howling over Wuthering Oklahoma before it falls down around us.
Connie Cronley is a Tulsa-based writer and essayist. Her latest book is called Poke a Stick at It, Unexpected True Stories from the University of Oklahoma Press. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.